This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On the show this week, I'll be talking with Peter Singer, Camp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, and our topic will be greed. Peter, glad to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you here.
All right, we're going to be talking about greed. Maybe it'd be helpful if you'd begin by explaining what you understand greed to be.
I guess I would see greed as excessive desire for acquisition of something that goes beyond what anyone would consider reasonable needs or desires, essentially perhaps typically the desire to accumulate something for the sake of accumulating it.
Okay, so you identified two different features of greed. Maybe let's talk about both. The first, what's common to both is this idea of an excessive desire to accumulate, but one sort of accumulation is accumulation so that you can use the goods, what you might call part of our consumer society. What if you talk about that one a bit, then we can come back and talk about the other one in a minute.
Well, in terms of what you can use, the question is, I guess, the creation of needs or desires that, again, might go beyond what, on reflection and sitting down and thinking what's really going to benefit you, you would see as part of a reasonable level of a lifestyle that we could endorse. I think we live in a society that tends to multiply what it likes to think of as needs, but I guess what really are desires, to the point at which you lose track of the original purpose of what you're doing. I mean, it's more like, you know, I've got to have one of those because I need this for that, but then you don't really ask the questions about, well, why do I need that?
Could you give a specific example? What's an example of what you might call a created need?
Well, I think, if you think about, for example, cars, I guess cars are useful things for getting you from A to B. But if you think that you need a car that will go from 0 to 60 miles an hour and 5.5 seconds, that's a created need. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that is really going to satisfy a transportation need. It's rather the sense that I have this Porsche or Mercedes or whatever it might be, which is better than what everyone else is driving, or something of that sort.
Any other examples?
Well, I think you see the same phenomenon more or less across the board at the, in the range of consumer goodies. You can take your stereo system to the same level. You can take your selection of fine wines or a choice of gourmet restaurants, all of these to the point where the difference between what you're actually getting for what you're buying and what you could get for a more standard and much less expensive item in that range is minuscule, but the sense of satisfaction people get, I suppose, is something like, well, this is the top of the range stuff, and I've got the best.
We're going to come back and talk about this later, but maybe you could just say a little bit in general about what you see as worrisome about the desire to accumulate, the desire to consume. I take it part of what you're talking about, too. It's not just that a person has an expensive taste for cars and everything else is more or less normal, or an expensive taste for wines and more or less all the other desires are normal. Part of what you're talking about, I take it, is being part of society in which you want more and better of everything.
I think very often, what we're talking about is simply the desire to be ahead of others, so that it's in a sense a status desire rather than a desire for the best quality in a particular line of goods. It's what Veblen, the sociologist back at the turn of the century, called conspicuous consumption. That is, it's really trying to show by your consumption patterns that you are a certain kind of person, that you have a certain kind of status that is ahead of what others have.
Well, now, okay, there are two different phrases you've used. One is the phrase just then, conspicuous consumption. At the very beginning, when you defined greed, you talked about it as an excessive desire for acquisition. But I'm sure that most people, most listeners today, would know some individuals whom they think conspicuously consume or have excessive desires. But for the most part, no one's, or certainly very few people, are going to think that about themselves. How do you decide what an excessive desire is? How do you decide when the consumption is conspicuous rather than normal or acceptable?
Well, of course, it's possible for a whole society to get so far down this track that the notion of what is normal in that society would be seen as excessive or greedy in other societies. And in fact, I think that could be said of the United States to some degree. You know, you compare the way people live in the United States and you go to countries which are also affluent. I'm thinking of European countries, for example. And you just, you know, you nevertheless, you don't see the same sort of sense of priorities in terms of pursuit of consumer goodies. So the idea of normality is, of course, relative to the society in which we live, but I think we need to be aware of that possibility that the society as a whole has become excessively skewed in one direction. Within a society, to get back to your question, within a society, I would say it's the test is really a loss of perspective on why you're doing something. That is the failure to sort of really sit down and think, well, you know, is this something that I really want, that I really will benefit from? Why am I doing this? Particularly when you talk about people who complain about how hard they have to work, how driven they are, what long hours they have to work, and, you know, really when you ask why they have to do that, then they say, well, otherwise I can't afford these things and those things. But and if they look at what it is that they're using the money for, maybe they'd be better off working less and buying less.
Okay, let's move now to the second part of greed. I mean, you talked about greed as being excessive desire for acquisition. Some forms of greed are in order to get goods to consume. That's what we've been talking about up until now. But you also talked about a second form of greed as one in which there's simply the desire to acquire goods for their own sake. Could you talk a little bit about that? Maybe say a little bit more about what you mean by that and how prevalent you think it is.
Well, I think that the acquisition of material goods is something that is sort of fostered all the time by what we see around us, by advertising, there is this sense that we have to have whatever else is that other people are having, that simply because it's there, we need to have it, and you see obviously various trends and things that catch on that some people have and then soon everyone has. And I think that's part of that, of what I'm talking about.
Okay, and do you see that as something that's actually happening a great deal in this society? And can you think of any particular examples?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, it's happening, that we see around us all the time. I think one example, I guess, is the sort of entertaining that people may do, which particularly for sort of family events, whatever they might be, you know, weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever. There's a standard of lavishness that you have to provide for your friends, because basically all your friends provide this for you on similar occasions, and I think, you know, that's something which has clearly sort of got out of any sense of proportion. It's got beyond any sense of proportion to something that becomes basically just a circle that goes around. Well, you know, everyone else has this, so we have to do that.
Okay, so part of what happens is individuals see others around them acquiring goods, see others around them spending money in certain kinds of ways, and they feel as if they've got to at least spend and acquire that much, even if they don't really want it, even if they aren't really going to be benefited by it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think you. I think you see that among your friends in various ways. You can see it. I think a good fictionalized version of it was Tom Wolfe's book Bonfire of the Vanities back in the 80s, where you have this bond trader who's earning $1 million a year and who still can't really meet all his financial needs because of the kinds of things that are required of him. I mean, you just have to have this 8-room apartment on Park Avenue. You can't possibly take a taxi to go to see friends. That's undignified. You have to have a limo. All of this kind of thing, which I think is still out there. It was sort of very prevalent in the 80s. It sort of dropped a little bit, I think, with the recession at the end of the 80s, but I think it's definitely back.
All right, let me ask about this. There's something very interesting, very peculiar that's gone on. That if you look back at traditional lists of the virtues and the vices, one of the things that was certainly counted as a vice for, I suppose most of modern history is greed. Greed was seen as something that it's at least unseemly, if not downright immoral, to be greedy. Yet it seems that greed is at least no longer condemned in the way it once was, and perhaps is now even seen as something positive. In fact, preparing for this show and another show on the same topic by someone in a very different view, I think I mentioned this to you. I did an internet search for the entire phrase, greed is good, and found more than 2,000 references in the internet to the phrase, which certainly would indicate to me that the idea that greed is a good thing is at least no longer condemned in the way it once was. How's that happened? How has greed gone from being a vice to being seen as something positive?
Well, firstly, I'm not sure that it is. I mean, you can't go by the number of internet references unless you actually check them all out and see what they're saying about it. They may be quoting the phrase, usually, I think, attributed to Ivan Bursky, the Wall Street broker who ended up going to jail. And they may be quoting it in order to condemn certain aspects of American society. I mean, I've done that myself. So I think there's some ambivalence about it. I also think that you are referring to a specifically American phenomenon. I don't think that this is a global view. I think America has been, some people might say, well, it's just been more open, less hypocritical in championing greed. But I suppose there is this view which goes back to it goes back a long way to Adam Smith in the 18th century, or Bernard de Mandeville, perhaps even earlier, that the desire for acquisition is what fuels the economy, and that, without it, we wouldn't all be as prosperous as we are now. So I think that's the sense that, yes, the strength of that ideology in the United States, the strength of the belief in the workings of free market capitalism and the competitive desires in human nature as working for the public good, that leads to the idea which you certainly see in some people, that that greed is actually a good thing.
Okay, I want to pursue this a little bit in the second half of the show. I'd like to pause for the moment, though, for the benefit of anyone who's tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Peter Singer, DeKalb Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. And our topic is greed. In thinking about what you just said, I can imagine someone holding the view that greed is not necessarily a good thing, it's sort of a necessary evil, that if people are greedy, that's going to help feed the economy, which will ultimately benefit all of us, including the poor. But there is another view which says something stronger, that tends to praise, to look up at people who are very wealthy, and at least the assumption is some of that wealth, some of those people have gotten their money because they've been preoccupied with getting the money. I see lists each year of the wealthiest people in the world, or individuals who have the number of people who have over $100 million. That seems like an odd thing to calculate if it's not in some sense seen as a good thing.
Well, it might be seen as a mark of success rather than a good thing in itself. That is, we have lists of the people who hit the most home runs in baseball or who can, you know, run certain distances the furthest, the fastest. So I guess one explanation of this might just be that we see life as a kind of a competition. Ivan Burski, who I mentioned earlier, sort of famously did the first time that he made the Fortune 500 list. He was dismayed because he was near the bottom, and he told his wife, I promise you we'll never be near the bottom of that list again. So, you know, it wasn't as if he really needed more money at this point. He had $150 million and wasn't actually someone with terribly extravagant taste because he just worked so hard he didn't really have time to spend money. But for him, obviously, it was a kind of competition. It was a mark of success in life. And I think that shows a distorted sense of values in itself, that we should see how successful we've been in life simply in terms of how much wealth we've managed to accumulate and not look at what we've done with it or what we've done with our life and our working hours. What good has it done, either ourselves or anyone else, rather than simply being an accumulation.
All right. In fact, that points a direction for the remainder of the show. You said, "What good is it to acquire? What good is it to spend your time acquiring? What good is it for you? What good is it for others?" It seems to me there are two sorts of questions which I would think in your own work that you would want to address. One is, what is it that makes you want to say about yourself that it's a distorted sense of priorities? What should one be doing differently? And secondly, it's going to lead into this, is how that preoccupation with money affects other people. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about both of those.
Well, I mean, what is it that you're doing with yourself? I guess, as I was saying earlier, it's a failure to really sit down and think about your priorities in life. Because if what it means is that you are, you know, simply running a race to earn more, then it gives you that goal during life. You know, you know what you're doing, you want to earn more, increase your wealth, etc. So in a sense, you don't have to stop and think, why? But I think a lot of people, you know, getting near the end of their life think, well, what am I going to do with all this? You can't take it with you, famously. If you've got children, you can pass it on to your children, but then, you know, a lot of people say, well, giving money to children spoils them. They have no incentive to work themselves, and there's so many stories of second and third generations of wealthy people who have, you know, not used the money wisely, to put it mildly. So, you know, for yourself, there's a question of, is this really a fulfilling, a meaningful life? Is this really a life that satisfies you, that you'll look back on at the end and say, well, yes, I did the things I wanted to do, and they were worthwhile things to do. You also asked about what is the effect that it has on others. Well, I would put it rather as what are the opportunities to have good effects on others that you might be foregoing by this single-minded focus on accumulation. Some of the most fulfilled and satisfied people that I've known have been people who have actually, you know, worked for the benefit of others, whether it's people close to them, whether it's the poorest people in the world in distant countries, whether it's the environment and future generations who will benefit from a clean, sound environment, or not for humans at all, but for other animals. You know, if you're simply thinking of accumulating, you're really turning your back on all of these other possible goals, which so many people have found as giving real meaning and fulfillment to their lives.
Okay, so would it be fair to say then that the idea that we ought to be asking what's going to make our lives meaningful is an entirely fair question? That itself is not, need not be seen as selfish. The problem is there are many ways in which you might find a satisfactory life, and perhaps trying to acquire money isn't necessarily one of them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we've been talking about greed. We've not been talking about selfishness. And, you know, then you talked about living a meaningful or fulfilling life. I think these are all different expressions which you need to carefully distinguish. I think everyone would like to live a meaningful or fulfilling life, and there's certainly nothing at all greedy in that. I mean, on one sense of it, it's not a selfish thing either, because, as I was saying, you may find the most meaningful or fulfilling life that you can live to be one that in which you are doing what you can to improve the situation of others, to help the weak or exploited, to protect the environment or whatever else it is. Now, you know, someone might say, well, look, you're still thinking in a self-interested way if you're asking yourself, how can I get meaning and fulfillment out of my life? But that's fine. I mean, you know, we shouldn't think of being self-interested in such a broad sense as a bad thing. It's certainly not greedy, and it's certainly not selfish in the narrow sense which we might give that word a pejorative meaning.
Okay, so what you've got in mind is someone who's really selfish is preoccupied by themselves. What they want to do is they want to get something for themselves. Sort of doesn't matter what other people think or how it affects other people. Greed, it would be a certain kind of selfishness. And all these are going to be distinguished from looking for meaning in life, where meaning in life certainly doesn't have to mean that you're selfish. In fact, it might even be, in some sense, incompatible with being selfish.
Yes, it's certainly incompatible with being selfish in the sense that says, you know, that means a focus just on yourself. And I would argue that that is probably something that in the end you're not going to find fulfilling. The Greeks had this idea of the paradox of hedonism, that if you pursue pleasure for yourself, you won't find it. Whereas if you go out and do something completely different, you will undo it, you know, with energy and enthusiasm and drive. You will find that you're enjoying doing it. And, you know, that's true of so many people, I think, that if you just say, well, I'm just going to, you know, really have a great time and just go to the beach and whatever else it might be, you know, eventually, you know, pretty soon, in fact, you get bored with that. If you take up some other activity that you find fulfilling and rewarding, you get the rewards. So I think that's the point about selfishness, that self-interest and selfishness are not the same thing.
Expanding on those themes in the last 5 minutes of the show, you want to say that you want to have a meaningful life, people ought to seek for meaningful lives. Part of what that means to have a meaningful life is to be concerned about things other than yourself. This is all going to be part of what you see as an attempt to live an ethical life. Maybe you can explain a little bit about what you mean by an ethical life, and then we can expand that a bit in the last bit of the show.
Well, I think living an ethical life is living a life in which you give consideration to the interests of others, whoever they may be. I would say that, you know, the test of whether you're living an ethical life is something like the famous golden rule, which has been around in so many different religions and cultures. The idea that you're prepared to think of how would I like it if they were doing this to me. You know, in other words, before I do something to you, I consider, would I like that if I were in your place? And if you wouldn't, well, you need to think about everyone affected. I mean, obviously, sometimes you have to do things to people that they don't like, as the judge might have to punish the criminal. But that's for the sake of others, again, who might be the future victims of this criminal if he or she goes unpunished. So, I think living an ethical life involves taking that broader perspective in which you consider the interests of all of those affected by your actions. And what I would suggest is that it's by doing that we can perhaps be on the safest road to finding a life that is meaningful and fulfilling.
Could you say a bit more about that? Because many people might find that, initially might find that hard to buy. I mean, a lot of people think of morality as forcing you to do something that you don't really want to do, that it's not really good for you, or if it's good for you, it's only good for you because of some sort of eternal payoff. Clearly what you've got in mind is something very different, that the meaning that living an ethical life can give you is, it's not heaven, it's not some reward afterlife, but nonetheless it is perhaps, well, it's obviously got benefits for others, but it's also perhaps the best way in which you could end up saying at the end of life that I've lived a life that was worth living.
Yes, I certainly don't see living an ethical life as dependent on religious belief or belief in an afterlife or anything of that sort to make sense. I think that there is a long tradition that sees living an ethical life as its own reward. It may seem to involve sacrifices or restrictions when you look at it from the perspective that we were talking about before, say, you know, accumulation for yourself, from the perspective of the person who is possessed by greed, then living an ethical life might involve sharing some of that wealth with others who are more needy, and that might be seen as a sacrifice. But that's only from that perspective, which itself fails to really look at what your priorities are, at what your life is about, at what you find fulfilling. So, you know, while I'm not saying that ethics and self-interest can never come into conflict, they certainly can, I also would see that for anyone with a certain amount of sympathy, compassion for others, benevolence, living an ethical life is going to be a fulfilling way of living too.
Okay. In the last minute, if you were going to leave a sort of final thought with the listener about greed and about the ethical life, what would it be?
Well, I think my final thought would just be to say that I think we would be a lot better off if people just paused for reflection a little more often, if they didn't just get onto a treadmill and feel that they have to keep going, and if they were a little more critical about the standards that are set by others around them, and rather they sort of, you know, sat down calmly and thought about their real priorities, their real values, and how they could live a life that was more in accordance with them.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking today with Peter Singer, DeKalb Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. Our topic has been greed. This is Hugh Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.